Welcome to the CIA and our discussion on Blake 7.
Agency. Today we'll be discussing Blake 7, and if you don't know what Blake 7 is, I'm sure someone in the room will be telling you in just a few minutes. So I'd like to introduce people that are talking today. We've got Ken from Doctor Who Podshock, another special guest today. Hello.
Great to be here. I'm looking forward to talking about Blake 7.
And we also have Diane, who, if you've listened to the last two episodes, have heard her excellent discussion. Hello, Diane.
Hello.
And Merlin is here as well, and he'll be chiming in from time to time. He sounds like he's having a little bit of a staticky problem, but we'll hopefully get that taken care of. But he's in the chat forum, so we'll get started. Okay, Blake 7. I guess we'll start with Ken. Ken, I think we've agreed that you're, before you got here, that you're like the resident expert on Blake 7.
I wouldn't say resident expert, but it is a favorite of mine, and
right.
it's just a show that just seems to get no love anymore. It's such an excellent show, and we're all speaking before the recording started that
I think we just had Dave come in. I'm sorry about that, Ken.
That's okay. I was waiting for danger, Will Robinson.
Yeah, sounds like an alarm going off.
Yeah.
Another show for another day. what we're going to do, Dave, is we're having a little bit of a sound problem for some reason with you and Merlin. This is when you want to say something, throw yourself up in the queue, and I'll let you in. God, it's great to have power. Power, power. This must go to Lewis's head from time to time. All right, what were you saying, Ken? I'm sorry.
We were saying about Blake 7. I find myself attracted to shows that are outside of the mainstream, and Blake 7 is definitely outside of the mainstream.
Oh, yeah.
Especially that you just can't find it anymore, especially here in the United States. I mean, I understand that in the UK you can rent some of the DVDs in video stores and stuff. And in the United States, forget it. If you want to find out about Blake 7, you're sunk.
You know, for Blake 7, I'll tell you one thing. I mean, it's an innovative show, and it's well ahead of its time because it's one of the first real sci-fi shows that had, like, a story arc. And in fact, the main character, Blake, disappears about three-quarters of the way through the series, and you don't see him again until the end.
It's very comic book-like in that respect. Chance-taking stories really only happen in comics, where you'd say, okay, like, remember the Iron Man when somebody else took on the Iron Man suit and wandered around for a little while. It's unheard of to say the lead actor is leaving, the name is disappearing, and somebody else is going to take over the show. I said, who does that on television? It doesn't happen.
No, not really. I mean, it'd be like if Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Buffy gets killed off, and then they don't ever bring her back, and it's still called the same show. I mean, you just don't have it happen.
It just doesn't happen. In American television, forget it. Imagine trying to do that. Imagine going into a meeting with network executives and explaining to them that the lead character, the namesake of the show, is leaving, and the show is going to continue. They would be like, are you insane?
Well, you know, that actually did happen. at one point. You remember the show Valerie? I mean, this is not sci-fi, but it's an old...
Yeah, yeah.
He left at the end of the first season, and then they kept the show on, but changed the name to the Hogan Family. And, you know, that's a bad analogy, but I guess...
That's the closest thing that they could do in American television, but they at least changed the name.
Right.
Blake 7 retained the name, but Blake 7... As a quick overview, as you described West on Podshock today, was a sort of the stepchild to Doctor Who, in that a lot of the creative forces behind Doctor Who helped create Blake 7, and it was supposed to be a little more adult than Doctor Who, in that it obviously was not geared for children. It was still a family show to a certain degree, but it ran in a more adult time slot, and some of the issues and concepts that they tackled in Blake 7 were more adult-oriented. It's been described by Terry Nation as the Dirty Dozen in space. I've described it to friends as Star Trek on acid. So make what you will of those two things, you know, because it's very Star Trek-like. It's almost as if Terry Nation saw the Star Trek, the classic Star Trek episode Mirror, Mirror, and said, what if we just made a whole show based in that, like, alternate universe where the Federation is bad? And hence he makes Blake 7. Like, okay, here's these characters, and they're going to go wander around the universe. And the characters, the main characters, what are supposed to be the heroes, are more anti-hero, where they're criminals. And
right.
They're left to fight in a society filled with criminals, filled with people who are all out for themselves.
We've actually got the one guy, Blake, is a freedom fighter, who he's the one with all the ideals, and the rest of the ones just kind of escape with him and then follow him around, and they're more for themselves than the ideals. It just happens to happen at the same time.
Yes, and at any moment they can turn on him, and on several occasions they try to, and some develop some loyalty to him, some don't develop any loyalty to him. And the little factions inside the group, which makes the characterizations and for on a weekly basis, keeps you coming back to say, I wonder what's going to happen this week with these guys. You know, they're not really, you know, this one over here doesn't seem very trustworthy, or this one here. You know, each week there was it changed. That dynamic changed a little bit because, again, they were all very selfish characters who were, you know, kind of worrying about themselves. A touch of The Prisoner as well in the show, in that the episode opens with some mind control and certain things happening over and over again. The show, the original story arc seemed, in my opinion, to have that Terry Nation wanted to have, there was a natural ending built into the show where this character Blake may be captured again and drugged up again and forced to confess, and the whole thing cycles over again. And then halfway through the series, they say, "Ah, the hell with that ending, let's do something else."
You're
and
right.
They go off in an entirely different direction.
You know, there's a lot of series that I can, just off the top of my head, that I think about that are obviously, I'm not saying based on, but the ideas are there. It's like Babylon 5 is one of them, and
Firefly.
Yeah, and... Oh, there was another one that just popped out of my head. Oh, Andromeda. Now, supposedly Andromeda was written well before Blake 7 ever came around, but, you know, the same kind of thing sort of happened as the main thrust of that series changed halfway through, and it just became more of an action-adventure show than it was originally. But it's just an underlying theme of, you know, you can relate to what the Blake and his crew are going through just by stuff happening in the world today. I mean, it's something that doesn't ever change, really.
The idea that the powers that be or the average person is up against forces that they feel they can't control, being government or the world or our surroundings, those are all things that will never go away. If there's an organized government for people to live with, then these concepts and these themes will always be, something to be explored. The idea of I think, especially in the United States, but around the world, those who live in a free society are always fearful. The freedom, you're only free as much as your ability to defend that freedom. So as free people, we're always worried about the freedom being taken away from us. And those are always themes that when we explore them in drama that are powerful. Because
right.
you were, you know, oh, wow, yeah, that, yeah, wow. What if we didn't have freedom of speech? What if we didn't have the ability to control our own destiny? What if, you know, and these are things that we worry about, that are in our minds, that are in free-thinking people's minds. And that's what Terry Nation decides to explore.
Right, and for those of you who are just tuning in, Terry Nation is almost famous. It's also famous for what reason there, Ken or Diane?
Or Lewis?
He's the father of the Daleks.
Yes. and really, quite honestly, only got had the ability to create this show because of the prominence that he rose to as a writer, thanks to the Daleks, in large part. You know, perhaps had the Daleks not been successful, a writer coming in and pitching a show like this, perhaps it would have been picked up, maybe not. And I think, you know, he used his status as Dalek creator. The BBC were anxious to see, wow, what's Terry going to pump out next? You know, he's been brilliant with this Dalek thing. And he said, well, I have an idea for a show. I suppose if any one of us went into the BBC and said, I have an idea for a show, they'd say, thanks for coming by. Security will be up here any minute now.
Right. I just noticed that it looks like Lewis is here as well. Hello, Lewis.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good. How are you?
Okay. It was just taking a quick little break between podcasts there. I'm glad you have me here today and at the CIA. I'm glad the CIA is not after Podshock in that other respect, but it's in this respect, it's fine.
Right. do you have anything you'd like to add about Blake 7?
Well, it's I unfortunately, since I came in late, I don't know what was already said. So, but it's Terry Nation's series that really explored a lot of different issues, and I think I caught a tail end of it. What Ken was saying before, so I think he probably covered most of the bases there. But for Doctor Who fans, it's if you're a Doctor Who fan, you'll see a lot of crossover actors and some similar themes. This was it was in the late 70s that Blake 7 debuted and crossed over into the early 80s, and you'll see a lot of reminiscence of that style of television. I think Wes, you may have said something in our Doctor Who podcast episode that we just did, that it's it had a very similar look and feel, and I think if you enjoyed that era of Doctor Who, you will enjoy Blake 7 as well.
But it
also had what I also enjoyed about Blake 7 is that, which was very different at that time, is that they had characters that really were real, where in a sense that they could die, and it wasn't just like red shirts that could face death. That actual characters may not be coming back for the next series, and it gave a certain realism that you weren't seeing in other shows, and also that all the characters were really, you know, the protagonists here were all criminals in a sense, you know, and that's something that really, you know, hasn't really been explored that much, and you know, on television, and it was refreshing seeing that not everyone was goody two shoes, that you know, they could be stabbing each other in the back as well. You know, so it wasn't always outside forces that were challenging them. Sometimes it was within their own camp, and that they had to overcome that.
Although they were criminals, they're very likable in many ways.
Even the ones
that are flawed.
Mm-hmm.
I think Avon is probably the best anti-hero ever written for television, personally.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
And well realized by Paul Darrow. You know, as far as having certain subtleties in his character that even to this day, watching it over and over again, is he insane? Is he not insane? Is he doing this on purpose? Is he, you know, like, there are still questions about his character that we don't have answers to that make it fun for rewatch value, that when you watch it again, you take it from a different angle, and there's still something to be discovered in the show.
Right. The one thing I remember personally about Blake Seven, and, you know, they showed it on the PBS channel, you know, the hour before Doctor Who came on, so it was kind of one of those, I started watching it because I was waiting for Doctor Who, and I got hooked on it, and the thing I remember most about it was just being surprised by the, I think today, it is still considered by me to be the greatest finale for a series, period.
Oh, yeah. That was the first thing I saw. This was, we were at a convention, and we saw the last 5 minutes of the very last episode, and that's what encouraged me to watch it. It's like, oh, my God, they killed the entire cast, so you just wanted to go back and find out how they got to that point.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. Too late now.
Sorry.
Well, it's interesting because it is a spoiler alert, and it isn't, because it is one of the things about Blake Seven that is very appealing about it, is that the show is so different and ends in such a unique way that when you know that happens, and I knew it going into Blake Seven, like you said, that you have to, how do you get to this point? How do you get to a point where the entire cast is just murdered?
Right.
You know? And show me a television show that does that anywhere.
Well, it was groundbreaking at that point as well. And I also have to say that a lot of modern-day television owes a great deal to Blake Seven, and tip of the hat to them as well. You know, if you're a fan of like Farscape, if you're a fan of the spin-off series Crusade from Babylon 5, many of these series really are, it could be argued, are remakes of Blake Seven, you know, in certain respects, where certain themes are being carried over and explored, you know, in their shows as well, and using the same type of format that they're felons and getting along and having to work with each other. And but, you know, so I really think Blake Seven really paved the way for many of the series that have strong followings today.
Lewis makes a good point too about the production values being similar to Doctor Who. If you like classic Tom Baker era Doctor Who, then you'll find yourself at ease with the look and feel of Blake Seven, as opposed, let's say, to Tripods, which I also adore and love, but clearly feels different than Doctor Who, even though it's a BBC production. Blake Seven feels very much in the Doctor Who vein, but almost the dark side of Doctor Who, things that you couldn't possibly do on Doctor Who. It's what they're attempting to do with Torchwood today.
I was just about to say that.
they attempt in Torchwood to make it the other side of Doctor Who. And for me personally, it doesn't achieve that where Blake Seven did.
And you got to see the same rock quarries as well.
That's true.
I think there have been many times where they were shooting, you know, Doctor Who on one side and Blake Seven on the other.
Whatever that noise is, bloody hell, it's Blake Seven.
Well, they were obviously using the same cast on a lot of episodes, because I know the guy that played Vila, Keating, I think his name is. He was on Doctor Who and the Sunmakers. And I just happened to see Blake Seven earlier that night, then I go to watch Doctor Who, and he's in the same episode, you know.
And practically in the same outfit.
Right.
He didn't even
playing the
costume.
Same character.
Yeah, he just... Hey, Mike, can you think you could show up on set number 22? They need you over on Doctor Who this week. Okay.
I just read all your lines from Blake Seven and it'll fit right in.
Paul Darrow as well, making a couple appearances in Doctor Who, but notably in Time Lash, playing against Colin Baker. And Colin Baker was a guest star in one of the Blake Seven episodes. And apparently,
Babin the Butcher.
Backstory. Yeah, a little backstory where they were trying to one-up each other in guest starring in the other one's show. and now that kind of explains the character of Hecker in Time Lash, sort of really just going for the gusto against Colin Baker. You know, you're like, okay, well, why would this guy do this? Well, you know, go check out Blake Seven, and you'll see why he's trying to.
And then you had Jacqueline Pierce and the two doctors, excellent role for her there.
I adore
Jacqueline. Oh, she was great. Yeah.
Adore her. First of all, we're talking about pioneering a female villain with such strength And the complexity of her character, that she does this because she's insecure. She's never, as a female character in 1978 television, to never be played down to. Her authority is always there. Unheard of in television. Completely unheard of.
Right.
And she made such a good villain in The Two Doctors as well, although she was kind of playing Servalan, but you can't beat it. She's a good actress.
Yeah, she's absolutely extraordinary.
Now, here's a quick question for you guys. Would you be interested in seeing him reviving it a la Doctor Who?
Yes.
Absolutely.
With the right people, I could see the current team that's working on Doctor Who, if they had the same people that they have there, and then the actors. But it would be a very hard thing to fill Avon's shoes.
Right.
Aren't they
redoing it? Aren't they doing it now on radio? Isn't there a sci-fi channel in the UK? They're revisioning it in an audio drama?
And for anybody who's listening on podshock.net, in the links section, in the web resources section, under other sci-fi, you'll find a link to the Sci-Fi Channel UK's website if you're interested in hearing the audio drama, the re-envisioning of Blake Seven.
But now, is that with new actors, or is that with the original cast?
It's almost like what they did with the new Battlestar, where they're re-envisioning it almost entirely. It's not just a different cast playing it, but they're trying to change a little of the feel and create their own thing. I respect that based on the fact that I've seen it work in Battlestar and I've seen it work in other mediums, including a bit in Doctor Who. And I agree. We all kind of said, yeah, we'd love to see Blake Seven back. But I think the crucial element is the casting.
Right.
Because I think just about any competent television writer, you know, it, like we've seen in the new Doctor Who with Russell T. Davies and on and on, I think good writers will be attracted to it. And the production values in 2007 would automatically lend it to looking better. But the key is the casting. And if they had the right people, the show would be extraordinary.
Right. I think you're absolutely correct on that one. Like, I was one of the skeptical few that was like, Battlestar Galactica without the original cast would never work. And then it did. So I was going to eat my words there for a second. And it turned out to be a pretty good show, but there again, I still think they could have done the same thing without naming it Battlestar Galactica, and everyone still would have liked it.
Yeah, they made a strong show and utilized the name in order to carry that, to help sell the show. But it was, even if you took the name off it, it's still just a great show.
Right.
Well, genre television has always been kind of iffy to begin with. I don't think it would have been as popular. I mean, it probably would have been a critical darling, but it might not have gotten rating success without the Battlestar name.
Yeah.
And then the controversy of bringing it back and the changes they made.
Yeah, instantly gave it free publicity, as you said earlier. You know, bad publicity is free publicity. And, you know, this whole, oh, Starbucks is going to be a woman thing and all that. It just instantly gave it, you know, there were postings on websites and news stories and a whole lot of publicity that the show normally wouldn't have had if it was just new sci-fi show XYZ is coming to the air. Okay, great. Next. You know. I don't know, maybe for Blake Seven's revival, they make Avon a woman and see what happens.
Well, you know, if the right writers at the helm, they can do just about anything, and it'll be good if it's done right.
Only Paul Darrow plays him as a woman.
Right.
I think it would work too, especially if they left Servalan a woman, because you know how guys love that girl on girl action.
Oh yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah,
and we're trying to keep it clean here.
I wouldn't know.
But I mean, it's hard to recast an iconic figure like Avon. I mean, the Doctor's a little different because it changes with every actor. So you can put anybody there, and if they're good enough, they'll make it their own. But to take a single character and put a whole different actor in there, I mean, that's kind of hard to do, especially when you got such a big fan base And, you know, Battlestar pulled it off somewhat. I mean, you know, the character's named Apollo, and he's obviously not Richard Hatch, but you get into the character a little bit. But, you know, Aven's a different story, I think. That'd be the hardest thing about the whole thing. I mean, Blake's pretty complex, but not like Avon is.
Well, Blake was very well defined from the beginning, so a new actor could take those same definitions and then interpret it in his own way. Avon was created on the fly by a single actor, so you can't just go back and say, okay, this is what they intended. You have to go back and study those aspects and figure out what it was that Paul Darrow was trying to do. But it would take someone extraordinary to be able to pull it off. Is it possible? Absolutely. There are plenty of talented actors out there. But
okay, here's a question. Who would you pick?
I've thought about that for a really long time, and I haven't got a clue.
David Tennant, obviously.
Oh, you know what? I'll give you one example. Christopher Eccleston.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
He's got the dark vibe going on. He's got the name recognition. I could easily see him playing a baddie, because if you've seen him in a few movies that he's played a bad guy.
He's awesome at it.
He's awesome, yeah.
Either him or Clive Owen.
Clive Owen, sure.
Yeah,
he was in... I saw him in Closer, and he was just nasty. But he had an intensity.
Of an action hero, yeah.
Let's just recast him with Timothy Dalton and let it go.
Timothy Dalton is pretty good. He just wasn't good as Bond.
I'm one of the few that liked him as Bond, I guess.
Well, you're not one of the few, because I really like Timothy Dalton.
Yeah, I was going to say I liked him as well.
I think he's like him, but not as Bond.
He was gritty. I think Pierce Brosnan was the rounded type of Bond that you like, with the sexy and the action and this and that. Timothy Dalton was a gritty spy, whereas Pierce Brosnan was more of what you expect from James Bond.
Well,
yeah.
You know, I think they had talked about Timothy Dalton at the beginning of the series as actually making a Bond when Connery left, and they thought he was too young for it.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think that was Pierce Brosnan, because they actually offered him the job and didn't get out of Remington Steele.
Yeah. Oh, that was,
that
was
later
Moore,
on,
that.
Though.
Yeah,
that was obviously because Remington Steele was in the 80s.
I think Roger Moore may have wanted to leave even before View to a Kill and maybe even stuck it out one extra movie because, you know, that Remington Steele commitment. And because I think universally amongst Bond fans, everybody thinks that, you know, that Roger Moore stayed one too long.
This is what I love about CIA. You come for Blake 7, you end with James Bond.
Oh, wait. Are you kidding me? We do this on Podshock every week. I mean,
oh, yeah. You get like fans together.
That's it. You know, but this is what the fun of this is that because the universe that we inhabit, being science fiction fans, is so vast.
Right.
And there are comparisons to be made. Because there are themes and ideas and even more practical terms, actors and production people, that cross over, through the genre.
Right.
I saw my friend had gone to England in November and brought me back a bunch of Doctor Who magazines and SFX magazines, and there was actually a pull-out poster where they linked Doctor Who to just about every single sci-fi TV show and movie ever. It's like they all had it. It was like the 6 degrees of separation, but they are all linked somehow back to Doctor Who, either by actor, by producer, by writer. So-and-so worked as a script editor on this one show, and now went on to do something else. And it's all interconnected.
You know, my fiance said it the best. She's not a sci-fi fan at all, and she can kind of tolerate the new Doctor Who. The old Doctor Who, it's like, I can understand why you wouldn't like it if you're not a sci-fi fan. But she said that her opinion of it is Doctor Who is like the I Love Lucy of television. You know, everybody copied it once it came on.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was on before Star Trek, and there were some things in Star Trek I remember seeing that have been explored in Doctor Who at one point. And, it was very pioneering. And Blake 7, it's kind of like taking the edgy aspect of Doctor Who that you couldn't really explore because it's more of a kid's show and throwing it out there for the adults.
And also, you can make it 6 degrees of or 7 degrees of Blake Seven. and, you know, how many shows, as we mentioned a little bit earlier, how many shows owe a lot to the template that was set for Blake Seven, what you could do and where you could go with characters and what could be accepted on television. Blake Seven was the first show that I'd ever seen in my life where someone could be shot in the back. Try doing that on American television. I mean, there was, like, some very strict codes as what, you know, oh, you can't shoot somebody in the back. Why not? Like, that couldn't happen in real life?
Yeah, that was the thing about Blake Seven, too, is that all the everything was messy. You know, all the interactions. You couldn't trust anybody. You know, one day you could trust him, the next day you couldn't. It was just like real life. It's you can't be certain of anything because anything could happen. And it was one of the few shows that actually didn't shy away from saying, it's like, yeah, this guy's a freedom fighter, but sometimes he's a real jerk, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes you'd want to shoot him in the back.
And sometimes he doesn't make the right move. And that's, right. You know.
Yeah,
there are consequences
sometimes they made
for
mistakes.
I would say the show today that kind of reminds me of the whole, you know, you can be a main character and die aspect would be 24. Because other than Jack Bauer, anyone can die, and as they quite frequently shown, one of the main characters will just snuff it, like, halfway through an episode. So that makes it more exciting and more realistic to me, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, network television, in the 60s and into the 70s, you knew who was buying it every week and who wouldn't, unless there was some kind of season finale, and even that got predictable, where, okay, it's the end of the season, maybe someone's going to buy the farm here. Blake Seven, didn't worry about things like that. Time for someone to, you know, to be shot. It's part of the story device. Okay, well, here they go.
that's become a lot more common these days. It's like Lost has been doing it. Heroes killed off a number of their heroes. And, yeah, as you say, you never had that, and I've never seen that until Blake Seven, that they actually had the courage to, you know, things weren't as certain as everyone thought.
Right, and Blake Seven, to me, seemed to bring politics to the forefront and made it kind of interesting to understand the politics of your time, because I remember after watching that show, you know, I would pick up things in conversations with, say, my parents. You know, I was in my 8 to 10 years old when I first started watching that, so I didn't understand some of the concepts in the show. And, you know, our PBS station only showed the run once, and, you know, I'm going by stuff I remembered 15 years ago or more. And I've seen a few episodes here and there because a friend of mine has bought several of them on VHS, but, you know, they only put, like, two at a time on there. And there's just some themes that just never changed throughout the entire history of mankind, I guess you could say, that they really did a whole broad sweep of stuff during that show, and that's why, to me, it never got boring.
Yeah, Servalan, as a character, had certain lines over the years in the show that she believed and that are scary, that there are people, leaders in the world, that almost echo some of the things she says in there. She says, there's one line, while there's life, there's threat. It's just, you know, it's over the top, but it's like there are people who are like that. Like, while someone's alive, they're a threat. Like, how insecure is this person? And, you know, things about how one-track minds they are when it comes to how they feel that their government or their world should be, and very intolerant in what they did in the show, you know, as the Federation is portrayed. So even so much we talked about it being sort of like an anti-Star Trek, taking the Federation logo and sort of tipping it to the side a bit. All these things are just, they're fun. They're fun to explore and they're fun to watch, and I really, really wish it came back to television.
Yeah,
it's
a shame that
these PBS stations aren't showing these series anymore. I mean, even classic Doctor Who and Blake Seven and Tripods, there's no excuse not to, you know, show this, because there's so many new generations that could be fans, and they just have no exposure to it, and it's a shame.
Well, you know, it's a testament to the series. You don't have to remake it to let people enjoy it. Just put it out there.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. You know, we have, five seasons? Put them out there.
Yes, four seasons of Blake's. And, you know, it's just, they're there, and if you enjoy the classic Doctor Who, and there's many people who are now being exposed to that, thanks to the new show, people are going back and exploring the classic series. Well, when that exploration runs out, they're going to look for something else to watch, and Blake Seven is a great starting point.
Not to interrupt, I was just reading something online about bringing Blake Seven back, and it says here that in Doctor Who magazine, the writer and producer of Life on Mars, so that he's been involved trying to bring Blake Seven back, and the storyline would be that a group of young rebels to rescue Avon, who's been kept cryogenically frozen by Servalan, and then run the galaxy in a new ship, Chris and the Liberator.
Wow.
So somebody's been thinking about it, definitely.
Well, and I'm glad it's the man behind Life on Mars. Again, we're getting credible names behind any possibilities. It was kind of like how I felt when Russell T. Davies was announced as bringing back Doctor Who. Here is a man with an impeccable resume. And you instantly felt that even if you didn't like his other work, that he had something to say and something to deliver, and he has.
And that is definitely the case.
Yeah, and I think the same thing can be said for, you know, someone who's behind a production like Life on Mars. You know what you're going to get. You know that there's an integrity behind it. So that even if you're not entirely sold on where they're going with it as a fan, it doesn't matter. They're still going to give it. They're going to interpret it a certain way. They're going to give it their best and try to make a statement with it, try to say something and bring it back for good reason, not simply to cash in on it, which has happened in the past on other shows.
Well, I feel with the BBC, with this hugely successful run of Doctor Who, that they're going to start mining their vaults about anything that can remake. But, you know, do you think, here's another question for everyone, do you think if they do bring back Blake Seven, they'd be better served to give it to a fan to run it, like they did with Russell T. Davies, or let someone take a whole new tangent?
Well, I think if this story about Life on Mars is true, they are giving it to a fan.
Right.
I think we have someone there who's already established themselves outside of Blake Seven as being a successful producer and writer.
Okay.
But they come from a background of growing up with the show, which is exactly what happened with Russell Davies.
Right.
It's not like this show got assigned to somebody and they said, "Hi, Tom, what are you working on now?" I got assigned Blake Seven. What's that? I don't know. They just told me to go make it.
I'm going to go check it out of the vault and watch it in the screening room right now. You want to come with me?
And that's happened. That happened to Buck Rogers. They shipped Buck Rogers after the first season to a man whose television credentials included, who were limited to Gunsmoke. So you took a man who produced Westerns and threw him in science fiction, something he had neither experience nor interest in. And the result was the second season of Buck Rogers.
God, that would be like giving something. That'd be like giving something like Star Trek to Rick Berman. Oh, wait, sorry, they did. That's another story for another podcast.
Yeah, a very long podcast.
Well, it's happened, unfortunately, many times before. The third season of Star Trek, the original series, the second season of Space 1999, where it's been handed over to a producer that doesn't really have their heart in it, or just has askew ideas, or none of their own ideas.
You know, that's a series that's aching for a remake, is Space 1999. I don't think it got near enough time on television.
I still don't understand why anybody enjoyed that show. I never saw the attraction in it.
Well,
I was dating
I enjoyed
a guy
the
who
first,
was
the first
really
season.
Into it.
The second one, they were just trying to capture a Star Trek's momentum, and I, you know, unfortunately, they tripped up on themselves. And again, you had Fred, the producer, Fred Frankberger, whatever his name was, I can't remember now, and the same producer that really messed up the third season of Star Trek, the original series, as well.
Yeah. And then, you know, he took the cast of Mission Impossible and put them on the moon, basically. And then didn't give them any kind of impossible missions to solve. You know, I thought the character they had in the second season that shape-shifted, you know, was very much like Hawk from Buck Rogers, you know.
Yeah. Maya.
Yeah, Maya, that's right. The thing I remember most about Space 1999, because, you know, obviously they don't show reruns of that anymore, even on Sci-Fi, and...
But it is available on DVDs, more than I can say, in Region 1, more than I can say for Blake 7.
That's true, but I also just read they're about to put some kind of big box set out for it, so there must be some anniversary coming up.
That's
double dipping time, I suppose.
Possible.
It's like, come on, let's double dip on some stuff that hasn't been around for a while.
Well, it's interesting, in Space 1999's case, they didn't go and release the entire season or the entire series. They split it up into this first half of season one, first half of season two, you know, just to see how much money they could get out of, you know, a few loyal fans. Lewis.
Yeah, no, they did that with Lost in Space, but Space 99, they just grouped them in boxes where, I don't know if they were like 8 episodes in a box or whatever, and so you had to get like, you know, you got both seasons worth with 8 boxes. But, I think we're steering away from Blake 7, but I just want to say that the first, in a similar note to Blake 7, I think Space 1999's first series broke new ground in television because they weren't afraid to do stuff that other television series weren't doing. They had scenes where it took place behind a window and you couldn't even hear the actors. It was very much molded after 2001: A Space Odyssey, the first series, and where it was grounded in that story type of storytelling, where it was very mysterious and sometimes less is more. And I think that's it's the not knowing, the mystery of being lost out in space, and which really I thought was an advantage to the series and the mystery of it all.
The thing that Space 1999 translated very well, more so than many other science fiction series before or since, was the coldness of space, because
yeah.
Mm-hmm. those techniques that Lewis is mentioning. It did feel cold. It did feel what we perceive space travel to be like. Authentic
yeah.
space travel, not, you know, traveling around a blue box, let's say.
Right.
You know, Star Trek never looked cold. You got aboard the Enterprise Bridge and you were like, yeah, it's like a living room, you know?
Yeah,
like,
basically.
Very comfortable, friendly environment. Space 1999 never seemed a friendly environment. It seemed like this was a harsh place to live, and it really sucks that these people are cut off from where they belong.
You know, just to invoke the Holy Trilogy for a second, but it's the same thing about Star Wars that I think was appealing to people was the fact that, you know, the ships look old and run down by the time that the A New Hope rolled around.
Mm-hmm.
And it was more realistic if you could have a realistic space show, you know. And that's why I think people did like shows like Battlestar Galactica. Everything looked kind of well-worn, and the characters weren't just cookie-cutter. And then you got Buck Rogers, which the characters were like a Saturday morning cartoon. It should have been a cartoon instead of a live-action series, I think. But I guess that's what I'm trying to say. Star Wars worked on such a good level because it was more realistic, you know, human drama than it was just sci-fi epic. And then Lucas totally, I think, went the other direction with the other movies, but they were fun.
Ridley Scott put it very well when he said, in his reaction to Star Wars, he said the universe looked very lived in. He says, this place is dirty, you know. You know, things are broken here. Something is in disrepair. And those are things that, you know, not everybody drives a brand new car. Well, not everybody flies a brand new spaceship.
No. I mean, the fact they spend most of the Empire Strikes Back repairing the Millennium Falcon is kind of a testament to that.
And
unless you're
not,
in gridlock, and then you're going to drive the same thing.
Yeah.
And it's one thing Blake 7 actually never had a problem with. Everything seemed to work okay.
That's because they had Orak and he took care of it all.
Yeah, and of course none of the characters actually knew how to fix anything, so that would have really slowed the story down a little. Like, hey,
well, it helped to have a self-healing ship.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. Hey, why bother with stuff like breaking down spaceships? We've got, you know, places to go and things to say. And that's what Blake 7 does. Each movie has an angle that they'll take on it. And you just mentioned that Star Wars looks lived in. The original Star Wars looks lived in. And that 2001 or Space 99 makes space feel cold. Everything has its place. In Blake 7, it isn't about lived in, and it isn't about the mechanics of the spaceship. It's about oppressive societies and not everybody being a hero and that kind of thing. That's what it has to say, and that's what makes it worth exploring for anybody who's listening who wants to. What's the benefit of viewing Blake 7? What's the benefit of me becoming a fan? That's their themes, this totalitarian themes.
But on the note of spacecrafts and all that, Blake 7's I believe probably was one of the first shows that had a regular character that was the spaceship itself. I mean, the Liberator was a character in itself. Zed and the Liberator, which had its own history, which we, you know, initially watching Blake 7, you don't know where the Liberator came from, who was the previous owners. And I think that added to the whole, it was another layer, another element of Blake 7 that was, I mean, I don't enjoy a series that has to explain everything to you. And I love the mystery and the not knowing, and maybe we're getting little crumbs of information as we go along on what the spaceship was about, and I thought that was a great asset to the series. And now, and like I mentioned before, other series today have done the same thing in homage to Blake 7, perhaps, you know, sort of like what was the series I mentioned earlier with that had the living spaceship and Farscape. And again, they everyone on board were basically criminals running it, but the ship was alive as well.
And in the positives of Blake 7, in a very natural way, we didn't find out about the spaceship till the second season. So it wasn't even like, well, Terry Nation held off telling us because he was milking it till episode 8 or something. He actually just waited the entire first season and not knowing what the hell's going on with the spaceship. And you know, again, those are things that don't happen. They didn't happen prior to Blake 7, and even to this day, they happen seldom, if at all.
Well, y'all want to talk about some characters you really love in the show? Now, we've talked about Avon. I think he's kind of above everyone else as far as the show really wasn't about him to start with, but, of course, by the end of it, it was.
You have Gan, who's a friendly giant. And
Villa.
Villa. I think that seems to be like everybody's favorite character is Villa.
The dynamic between Villa and Avon was really good stuff. I mean, I haven't gotten to the end of season 7 as far as rewatching it from when I was very young. But, yeah, the dynamic there is wonderful. That's good stuff.
Yeah.
When I go to Target, there's a section, you know, with all the home goods, and they used to have a sign that said Homeworld. And I still go in there, and it's like Homeworld, Villa World.
Yeah,
you're Home World.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, Villa was one of those people that's like, he's terrified of everything. He's a thief, so, you know, he can be your friend, but he'd steal the watch right off your wrist. But he's very heroic, believe it or not, when it comes down to it. I mean, he had this underlying heroism that hardly ever showed up, but when it did, it really, really mattered.
Yeah,
here's loyalty, too.
He said in one episode, there isn't a lock I can't open if I'm scared enough. And that kind of sums up his character, is that that's what makes him brave, is when, you know, when his rear end's going to be in the fire, you see how fast he'll act, and he does.
He'll get himself out of there real fast.
Yeah.
And the benefit is everyone else gets to go, too. You know, I was thinking about what you were saying earlier, who would play Avon, Diane? I'm thinking the guy that's going to play Saxon in the new series of Doctor Who. I think he'd be a good one.
Yeah, he would.
He'd be an excellent one. If you're going to pick today's British actors, I wouldn't even hesitate. I wouldn't even try to. It's like trying to cast Doctor Who with an all-American cast. That's just impossible. I can't think of it.
Yeah, that there's just some things that are meant to be British. And
yeah.
Well, they're redoing Life on Mars in American.
I'm scared. Very scared.
Yeah.
Be afraid. Be very afraid.
I'm scared, but if there's a show that could translate to American television, it's that one over, say, you know, Coupling. They did a terrible job of that one. And
I'm sorry. People talking dirty, it's much cuter when they're English.
Yeah.
Well, not only that, but U.S. tends to go with cliches, and if it's going to be set in the 70s, it's going to be the Brady Bunch, you know, and it's I'm sorry.
It's going to be Starsky and Hutch is what it's going
to
be.
That's what I'm afraid of, yeah.
Like, well, you know, that's what struck me when I was watching it, is that it did remind me a lot of Starsky and Hutch, only the acting was a lot better. But if they can keep the grittiness that the British version did, which I think it will be okay, because that seems to be the trend now, is that gritty, dark, you know, atmosphere. It seems to be that a lot more shows are going that way, and the only problem would be is if it got lost.
They probably won't use any of the popular music at the time because of rights and they would have to pay the artists. So that element will be lost. And I don't know. I just, you know, it's the series is great the way it is. Just play the real version. We don't have to remake everything.
Yeah, actually, they could put that on it, like ABC or something. It would probably be a hit, even as a current version with British actors, because it's just that well written. Just like, you know,
it's just this American phobia that the American television industry has about British-speaking television series, where, you know, they think the fools in the American viewing, the vast population won't understand English-speaking actors. And
well, Lewis, they're speaking a different language.
Yeah, they are, and I've got
two
to admit,
cultures separated
have a hard time. Some of the accents, I mean, they're very authentic to the region, but some of them are very hard to understand.
You know, we probably understand them more than your average American because we've watched Doctor Who over the years.
Yeah,
and that's why
we've
pick it up.
Yeah,
we've had plenty of exposure to English television, or I should say, British television.
Yeah, who is planning on doing this American Life on Mars?
David Kelly.
And for what network? Do you know? I mean, this is the first I've heard of it. So
I think it is ABC.
Yeah, I think so. But yet he's the one who did Ally McBeal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he did The Practice too.
Yeah.
So I mean, he's a good producer. I would feel better if, say, someone like the crew that's running Lost right now with Damon Lindelof and the Alias guy, what's his name? J.J. Abrams. We're probably really good at running that show.
Abrams is directing the new Star Trek, isn't he?
Yeah, and that's going to be an interesting concept as well.
Interesting is your choice of words on it. Mine is, you know, not hopeful. Rick Berman has a bee in his bonnet for years now to have this Academy Days thing. He's been talking about that. He was talking about that at Roddenberry's funeral.
Right.
So, you know, that's been on deck for a really long time. And sometimes things don't materialize for very good reasons.
Right.
There's reasons why they didn't do that.
You know, if you're going to do something like that, why not just jump another 200 years in the future and do a whole new thing? You know, that way you don't screw up continuity.
Yeah, because that would make more sense. They rather recapture a built-in audience. You know, they know everyone's fans of these other characters, and they want to just stick with them instead of, you know, and they just want to beat a dead horse.
Or what they could do is just not make Star Trek. I mean, I know that might sound sacrilegious to some people, but, you know,
you could give it a rest, and you know, after a period of time, just like Star Trek between 1969 and 1979, there was no Star Trek except for the animated series. this hunger was built up, and a desire for, and especially after Star Wars opened the gates for science fiction, it was even more so. You know, that can happen again. You can just rest it for a while and then bring it back the way it should be brought back.
A very excellent example of that is Doctor Who. I mean, it took a, 15-year hiatus, and now it's back better than ever.
And the reason it's better is that there's fresh blood involved in producing it. Because anything that Rick Berman's going to produce is going to be the same thing as Rick Berman has produced. So
you need fresh blood, fresh minds, fresh ideas.
Absolutely.
Let's let Joss Whedon run Star Trek for a while and see what happens.
Sure.
I think that'd be fantastic.
Let Joss Whedon do anything.
Fox, it'll be okay.
But even that series probably has owes something to Blake Seven as well, I would
say. The anti-heroes and, you know, absolutely. I definitely see some nods in Firefly to Blake Seven. As well to many other shows, of course, but, you know, the anti-hero status is and the ability to take plot turns that are not typical, and I used this with Lewis when I was first trying to get Lewis to view Firefly. So there's a moment where one character is talking to somebody, and the bad guy is giving the typical line like, "I'll hunt you down," and blah 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 blah, and the
he just shoots them.
Yeah, he just kicks him. He kicks him into the engine.
Yeah,
right.
I remember that. That was shocking.
Yeah, but that doesn't happen, and that's what. When I saw that, I said, this is a great show. I enjoy this. Because that doesn't happen.
Well, I tell you, I was a big Buffy and Angel fan, but I think I enjoy Firefly better than those two. And the thing is, I personally think Joss Whedon is the master of dialogue. He knows how to write for people where they sound like they're really talking to each other.
Yeah, he really does a nice job. The characters are not cookie cutter. They're very different. You might have somebody who's a certain type of personality, but they're not cardboard. There's some kind of depth to them. Just because someone is a coward doesn't mean that they're scared every moment of the day. Just because someone is a hero doesn't mean they're perfect every minute of the day.
As a matter of fact, most of the cast or characters of Firefly are pretty much cowards a lot of times, but that's what saves their lives all the time.
Yeah, you know, that is not pure heroism that, you know, let's go running in kind of thing. There's trepidation and there's a hesitation in doing things that are dangerous. Or they really, matter of fact, through the entire series, they want to lay low.
Right.
You know, what kind of television show do you have seven characters who just want to lay low? I mean, where do you go with that? But they make it work.
Right.
They make it work.
Look. And Nathan Fillion's Mel, I mean, he's not a coward, but he's no good in a fight. He always gets beat up.
Right. I think one of my favorite lines in a movie or TV period is in the Firefly movie, Serenity, when they're, you know, going down to the planet at the beginning, and he's asking Wash what the problem is, and, you know, how bad is it? And he goes, oh, God, we're all going to die?
In the movie.
That's awesome.
So, boy, this is my kind of podcast. We've gone on 100 tangents.
Well, see, that's why we kind of started it, because, you know, with you guys, it's structured, because it's Doctor Who. But this one is like, Doctor Who? Who's that? You know, it's under...
With many off-ramps, apparently.
We are the Celestial Intervention Agency. We change everything.
Well, guys, it's been a blast. I have to step away. Thanks so much for inviting me onto the podcast. I've really had a great time. I mean, we talked about so many different things, not only Blake Seven, but talking about Firefly and Battlestar and everything. It's really been a blast.
We hope you can come back soon. And, you know, if it's a matter of scheduling, we could definitely do this before PodShock as well, you know, even on a different day. We're still in our infant stage here. This is number 3. Y'all remember what it was like to be number 3.
Yeah, oh, I certainly do.
Well, I think you're off to a good start.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I'm going to make my way out as well, but I do want to thank you once again for inviting us, and you know, it's a great pleasure chatting, you know, about everything.
Right. Call it the Life, the Universe, and Everything podcast, I suppose.
Yes.
And we're looking forward to coming back at some point, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Well, we definitely can't wait to have you again. And I'd like to, I guess this would be a good place to end it. Thank you, everyone, for being here, Diane and Lewis and Ken and Merlin and Dave. Dave, I hope we can get you on here.
Yeah.
But everyone else, thank you for dropping by. And this is the CIA signing off. Y'all have a good day.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Shattered dreams, worthless years. Here am I encased inside a hollow shell. Life began, then was done. Now I stare into a cold and empty. The many sounds that meet our ears, the sights our eyes behold, will open up our merging hearts and feed our empty souls. I believe when I fall in love with you, it won't be forever. I believe when I fall in love this time, it will be forever. Without despair, we will share in the joys of care and will not be replaced. What has been must never end. When the truth and love are planted firm, they won't be hard to find. And the words of love I speak to you will echo in my mind. I believe when I fall in love with you, it will be forever. I believe when I fall in love this time, it will be forever. Ever, ever, ever. I believe when I fall in love with you.